Mac, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We are in football season, but that doesn't mean we're not merging the streams. If you're familiar with our WNST sports, you will now find that at Baltimore Positive. You go to WNST.net, you'll go to Baltimore Positive anyway. Don Moeller and I have been pulling this thing together, and you know, we don't do a whole lot of these segments. We had done over 300 segments when we launched a new website, and I don't know, other than handful of Dick Casses and maybe a Ron Shapiro here and again, or somebody who played high school football. We haven't merged the streams here, but when Moeller found out that I had a fellow Gale on and saw that piece that Mike Freeman and I did about the snake a couple years ago, and Freeman's got a new book, West Side, and he has moved all around the United States covering the National Football League and really on the topic of social justice at this point. Boy, times have changed since you and I got together. Freeman, I had to figure out how long ago that was. It was the Houston Super Bowl because we were talking about the Atlanta Falcons and winning and whatnot. And I checked out that piece on YouTube. And lo and behold, how much the world has changed in these three and a half years, huh?
It's been crazy. And I always love coming on with you. You're just a really good, genuine guy. You're a smart guy. It's always fun. And every Super Bowl we do with you is always fun. So I always love coming on with you. Thank you for having me on.
Where are you living these days, man? Where's home?
I'm still in New Jersey.
All right.
I wish I was in Maryland.
Are you in North Jersey, Mike?
I'm in North Jersey. So my mom still lives in Columbia, Maryland, where I grew up. And go Gales, baby, St. Joe. And we were talking before the show about how when I was there, I played football there 2 years, 3 years, I can't remember. We were terrible, but I loved it. Like, it's one of those deals where you never forget that stuff. You never forget.
We're going to sing a little. You know, I could do it for you, Mike. I can do purple and cream mean victory.
Oh, jeez, here we go.
He's been colors in a rain.
Yeah.
Watch our team go down the field.
There goes all the listeners. We're not even going to get to the book.
Go.
Oh, wait a minute, Nestor. If unto defeat we fall, we'll be loyal just the same.
We'll
fight team for the purple and the cream in Mount St. Joseph. Bless her name. Boom, boom.
All right, there you go. All right, there you go.
That's how you do it. Right there.
You know what, Mike? I wore pink this week for Crucial Catch, you know. And, you know, one of your brethren, James Schwartz, will be trying to figure out the Lamar show. I want to promote your book and background and all that stuff, but this has been quite a time, right, for the league, for everything. You've got a book coming out. We've got an election happening. Social justice, the league, masks, no fans, some fans, there'll be people in Philadelphia. I mean, there's a lot of directions to go in sports in this world, and certainly we're the book you've written here, right?
Yeah, so this is one of the craziest times we'll probably ever live through. I mean, how many points in history where you're living through an election, a pandemic, the social justice issues, all of these different things colliding at one time. I mean, the 60s, you saw a lot of this, and the 60s also had a war. So it's not
getting a great level on you, Mike. Just a little louder if you can. That's all. It's just the Zoom thing.
Well, it's we've lived through some of this in the past. I mean, in the 1960s, but this is different. It's not quite as intense as that. I mean, in the 60s, you had assassinations, you had wars. But this is pretty chaotic and pretty, it's really strange and sad. There's optimistic parts of it too. There's parts of it that you feel like we can change and we're moving towards that change. But it's one of the things that I really like about what's happening now, despite some of the really horrible things that have happened, is just how sports has, this is our bread and butter. Sports has sort of served as one of the catalysts for some of these things, for some of these changes. And in the past, in the NFL, in the past, a lot of players were always hesitant to do some of these things. They were hesitant to talk about race. They were hesitant to talk about social justice because the teams didn't want them to. And if they did, they suffered consequences. You could get cut, you could get demoted. That fear is gone now. That's one of the really remarkable points about this time. That fear is gone.
But it doesn't come without the pioneers taking the arrows.
Yeah, and one of those pioneers is a guy, you know, I focus on in this book is Colin Kaepernick. He's one of the pioneers in 2016 when he was taking a knee. A lot of people were afraid to join him. He was portrayed as an American, as someone that hated the police, that hated the military. None of that was true. It was never true. And he made it repeatedly clear that his protest was never anti-police or anything like that. It was never about that. It was about drawing attention to the issues. And then unfortunately at the murder of George Floyd, some of the things that happened in Baltimore that finally made almost everyone sort of look at the issues that Colin was talking about, some of the other guys were talking about, finally said, yeah, he was right. And it took some gruesome things to occur, some horrible things, but finally a lot of people, the majority of people, look back at Colin now and say he was right. At the time, that wasn't the case. And that's one of the things that's changed.
Well, I can assure you that that was the case, Mike. I know you're looking at your screen. I'm going to share this out on Twitter. This was September the 17th, or September 24th, 2017. This was in Wembley. And I'll tell you what, man, we were over there with, maybe 30,000 Ravens fans. Ravens got waxed that day. Yeah. That was the first game on that Sunday morning. I've now talked, and I keep close company with the Marvin Lewis's and a bunch of coaches who were coaching in the league and trying to figure out their owners, their players. That was an incredible weekend because the division began immediately with the SOBs and this guy running the country that we've talked a whole lot about. That, by the way, if you're listening in Pennsylvania, Ohio, Wisconsin, Florida, Texas, Arizona, anywhere you can take him to, I'm holding my ballot. Don gets mad because I haven't put my ballot in the thing, but I keep telling him if I put my ballot in the box, I couldn't hold it up. My ballot will be counted, Moeller. Relax.
Get that thing to the Dropbox.
I'm saying, Mike, is I'm a sports radio guy from Dundalk. You mean? And I've made a living doing sports forever, and I thought sports was here forever, and I built a radio station. I thought radio was forever 20 years ago. I've learned differently. The new website will tell you that. But having sports taken away in March, seeing the knee, I live in Baltimore. Moeller is still cozy with the Orioles. No one else is, right? So the Orioles are in the last year of a lease right now. I've seen this sort of attrition of sports that really sort of I date back to the knee where it became black and white, upper deck and lower deck, suburbs and cities, red and blue, and it went right down the line there, and Kaepernick became the lightning rod on all of it. And I know this is where your book comes in, right? Like, and we're getting up on 3 years on that. We're getting up on voting. And I find it fascinating that there are still people in the league who will tell you he wasn't blackballed. That's amazing to me.
It's amazing because he clearly was. And you talked about one of the things that happened with Kaepernick in that division is the president took advantage of it. The president purposefully went in to portray Kaepernick and protesting players. I mean, these are the words the president used, sons of bitches. He called them sons of bitches. So if you have, and this is the first time, again, by the way, that really in the history of this country, that a president did what Trump did, where a president intervened in sports like that to portray players as un-American. That has never happened before in the history of this country. Presidents have intervened before to make sports safer, like led to the creation of NCAA, Roosevelt, and things like that, but no one had ever done what Trump had done before. So if you have the president of the United States sort of stoking this division, then it made it much, much worse, and it may have been otherwise. He really just stuck his foot in there and stuck his fist in there and just tried to just hammer home that these guys were un-American and a threat. And that is really what was one of the big things that caused that it to get so ugly and for people to think that these guys were anti-police, because you had the President of the United States, among other people, saying that. That was never true, though. So he just made things far worse, like he does with other things, but he made it far worse. And then again, with the passage of time, you really see who was sincere, who was really trying to make change, who was trying to really draw attention to these issues, and who was in it just to be a charlatan, just to be a phony. What time has done is just prove who's right, who's wrong, who was always in it for the greater good. And 4 years later, we know who's on the right side of the issue, who's always on the right side of the issue were the players.
Well, Mike, it's so interesting. And what your book does is frame it for folks and try to put it into a political context, a historical context that Nestor alludes to. I think it is really important because it gets lost in the discussion that the president weighed in. This was Kaepernick took the knee the first time, September 1st, 2016.
Yep.
That was 2 months, about 10 weeks before the 2016 election. President Trump knew then and knows now exactly what he was doing and what he is doing. And maybe you can talk a little more about that, because people only half joking will say to me, my son said to Nestor the other night, Mike, he said, I'm actually worried. I didn't know this. My son didn't tell me. Nestor told me this afterwards. He said, I'm actually worried about my dad if this election goes the wrong way. And I tell folks, they have a right to be worried, because I can't imagine, forget Trump. He'll be here, gone tomorrow. He is what he is. But what I'm having trouble getting my head around and continue to grapple with is that there would be enough people in the United States of America, yeah, who embrace an overtly, not a dog whistle, an overtly racist message. And back in September, when the president got involved, he knew exactly what he was doing. For 4 years, he has continued,
yes,
that crusade. And as recently as about 10 weeks ago, chastised his staff that they were not allowing him to be racist enough. They wanted him to moderate. He said they didn't get it. He was going to bet that racism still played in the United States. And since that 10 or 11 weeks ago, we have seen him on steroids with the racism. And I wonder if you can react to that and put it in the context of your book.
Yeah, I think you hit on a lot of really great points. Donald Trump came into the race with birtherism for 5 years. He made it clear what he was, who he was. I mean, I've been in New York and New Jersey for a long time. Like, here, everyone knew what Donald Trump was. A lot of America really didn't. And so when he started with birtherism, that really launched his campaign. I think a lot of New Yorkers, New Jersey people were like, this guy is just completely, no, who's going to buy this? And I think one of the things I talk about in the book, and one of the things that's important to remember in all of this, is that you hit on this. It's sad to say, but it's true, that there's a significant swath of America that likes what he says. And we have to come to grips with that. A lot of us have. A lot of us have known this. But I think...
And we always say that's not who we are. Maybe.
But it is. It is. That's the part. That's an important part of this. And
we don't want to believe that, but here we are.
I mean, he got how many, 60 million votes? I mean, it was a lot less than Hillary Clinton did, but he got a lot of people who liked what he said, and a lot of people like what he says now. It's why he's still in this race. It's why he still has a chance. So that it is who we, a significant part of this country is that way. And I think what you saw was how he used race to get into power. And I think you're seeing him try to use race to stay in power. What I'm hoping happens, and it's starting to sort of look this way, and I hope it stays this way, is that there's going to be a lot of people who are like, I sat out this last one because I didn't think anyone would ever vote for him. Boy, I was wrong. And I'm going to make a statement. I think you're seeing a lot of people want to make a statement against what he stands for, against who he is. I agree with everything you just said. If though he wins, it's going to say even more about us, because if he loses, there's a way of thinking that he was an aberration. We can debate. We could spend like hours debating
that it's going to die off.
Right. If he wins, though, that says a whole different message about the country, and it's not a good one.
There is no doubt that these are perilous times. While we look at that and think about that, Mike, I wonder if you can also reflect a little bit about the historical construct of strong African Americans, particularly males, making a public statement. Now, Nestor, you're way too young. Mike's too young. But I remember as a young boy just being enamored with Jimmy Brown. I mean, Jimmy Brown was not only this great football player from Syracuse, he was the first African American, that people don't realize, that was a phenomenal lacrosse player. He was just this superhero kind of guy. But wrapped around that with Jimmy Brown back in the early 60s was he was also the first, that I recall, African-American male to say, you know what? This country doesn't always work for us. It was the Doc Rivers message 60 years ago, right? It was, I'm trying hard, and this country doesn't always work for us. And whether it was Jimmy Brown or Harry Belafonte or all those folks, Sidney Poitier, all those folks who were trailblazers back then.
Let's not forget the Olympics.
And Tommy Smith and John Carlos in 1968.
Shout out to David Steele, your mother's neighbor. There you go, Freeman.
You go. Talk a little bit about that history of African-American athletes taking a risk, because it's a real risk. And you talk about that in the book, about the threats on Kaepernick and the others that African-American males take when they step out in the United States of America.
Well, Nestor, you hit on part of this when you talked about the people that came before. So Jim Brown is in the Lacrosse Hall of Fame, the Pro Football Hall of Fame. He was the first black action hero in Hollywood. He made Westerns. He was a huge box office draw. He starred with all these stars at the time. He was unapologetically black, to just be blunt about it. And he spoke very bluntly, very differently than a lot of other black athletes would at the time, because he was fearless. And he did something that relates to now with Colin and what Colin did. Colin decided, I'm going to use my power as a quarterback to bring awareness to this issue, to systemic racism, to black and brown people, how the police treat us. So he said, I'm a quarterback. I have a certain high platform, a certain profile. I'm going to use that power to bring awareness. Brown did that too. You talked about the Olympics, the raised fist. That was the same thing. There have been examples of that. In the past, Brown was a bit of an exception, but when particularly black athletes did that, they were admonished, and a lot of times they were crushed. They were destroyed.
Well, in the case of Ali or Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, you know, the former Lew Alcindor and Cassius Clay, changing names was very much, you're black, we're not. And I mean, my dad was Archie Bunker in 1973 when I was a boy about those issues. He liked Cassius Clay more than he liked Muhammad Ali, right?
Right, and you mentioned David Steele's book, excuse me, chronicling what happened at the Olympics. What happened to those guys was just disgraceful. I mean, they were just shamed and told that they weren't American. And initially, the same thing happened to Colin Kaepernick. I mean, he's in a long line of great men who stood up for what they believed in, but also in a long line of great black men and black activists who, when standing up, were people attempted to crush them. And that's initially what happened to him. And to this day, he is still blackballed. But it switched. What happened in this case is a little bit different, because we had a tragedy that helped people sort of realize how great he was. So even though he's blackballed from the NFL, he has been able to, unfortunately, because of what happened to George Floyd and how people said, oh, Colin was right, Colin's been able to sort of flip the script a little bit and been able to do a lot of stuff off the field, bring more attention to it. His NFL career was crushed, but off of the field and away from it, he's prospering. He has all these different projects going on. He's been able to really rise from being blackballed by the NFL. He's rare, though. He's rare. Jim Brown's rare. Ali was this way. But most guys who try to do what Colin did end up being crushed.
The book is Football's Fearless Activist. I'm going to share it out here now. Simon & Schuster, Mike Freeman, author of Jim Brown and Snake as well. I think we were talking about the snake the last time we were together. You can find that out on YouTube as well. The book is out, and of course, you can find Mike Freeman, not at Mount St. Joe anymore, where Don Mohler will be singing the Purple and Cream song that I'll never get over, quite frankly. But Mike covers the league. Mike, you know, I want you to step out and talk a little bit about your career in covering the National Football League and just writing books. And I follow you out on Twitter, and you know, you're loud at various points, and then also between the lines at various points about the games and offenses and defenses. But some folks stay between the lines. Some people cover the news part of it. You've always been sort of, you know, on social justice issues, obviously, going back to the Brown thing. You've written 9 books. But in doing this book, Why Here, Why Now, I always ask that. And you have such access to all of this, and you didn't fly in to do this. You were, you know, I'm sure at Kaepernick's locker back four and a half years ago, that there's some details in this that and some storytelling that maybe we don't know about.
Well, I always felt like these guys were just at their core, just were heroes. There's different kinds of heroes. There's military heroes. There's political heroes. There's all kinds of people who do heroic things. These guys were those guys too. I mean, they were taking risks with their careers, especially Colin. Colin knew from the very beginning that if he did this, there was a really good chance that he would be basically run out of the league. I mean, he's not stupid. He's a really smart guy, and he knows history, and he knows what happens to a lot of players, to a lot of people who stand up. They end up being punished. So he knew there was a good chance of that. I just wanted to, one of the things I want to do was just document just their bravery, to be blunt. I mean, yeah, they make millions of dollars. They're very wealthy. They're very powerful, but they could have lost all that in an instant, and they all knew it. They all knew they could have lost it. And they were also going against very powerful forces, a president, a right-wing media machine that is incredibly powerful and vicious, like Fox News. And some of the things that were said about them by people on the right was really remarkable, and not in a good way. So I just wanted to document why they started it, how it started it, how it happened, and how it's relevant today, and what they still... what they did is still very relevant today. It's still 4 years later, we're still fighting these battles. There's still this president. There's still these things going on. All these issues that they addressed is still there. And I've always wanted to just talk about this stuff because I don't think you should ignore. I'm glad you're doing this show. This is fantastic. What you're doing is fantastic because it should not be ignored. We shouldn't act like it's not there. I mean, we all see it. We all experience it.
I'm sort of blown away by it. I mean, I cornered Goodell in the back of the press box during that period of time, and the Ravens were flirting with signing Kaepernick, if you remember this. And then the Pig Sox, in combination with the girlfriend from Atlanta, with the Ray Lewis, and you know, like, it really – it sort of excluded Steve from doing it. Steve was interested in doing it. I could feel the conviction. I was there when he was talking to season ticket holders, and really, it wasn't even season ticket holders. It was clubs. It was the serious suite holder folks that were really up in arms because of the proximity to military and all that went on. And I really believe we had Dick Cass on. And look, I've been around them a lot, from Ray Rice and going back to Ray Lewis's transgressions and Jamal Lewis and all of the things that have happened. I really do believe they were interested in signing Colin.
Oh, Nestor, there is no doubt. You and I have talked about it. As chance would have it, as a result of my having the opportunity to be chief of staff to county executives and then county executive, I was actually on the sideline of a practice out in Owings Mills the morning after Colin Kaepernick's girlfriend sent out the ill-advised tweet about Ray Lewis. And I was standing with Dick Cass, and we talked with Dick about this on the show. There was no doubt that the Ravens had serious interest in bringing Colin Kaepernick in, and that tweet was like the nail in the coffin.
But, you know, I'll say this. I don't think it was a done deal one way or the other. And, Mike, right, to some degree, and look, I'm not arguing the other side of this. He was blackballed straight up. But right, there was also the fact that this started to sort of get in the way of the football, right, for the 49ers and for him. And the question was, you know, are you going to be a backup or are you going to be a starter? What's the quality of your football? And there are people making all sorts of judgments on all sides of whether he could play. And he certainly was among the top 64 quarterbacks. But the Ravens came close, and then he didn't do himself any favors, you know, along the way. So, I mean, I'm mixed up about it in regard to him. But I'm also, you know, I know what the league did to him, but he didn't help himself. I want to point that out.
A couple things I'll say. His girlfriend, Nessa, I know her. She's fantastic. I mean, she's brilliant. She's smart. She's terrific. You guys bring up good points about did he help himself. The only thing I would say to that, I'm not saying this about the Ravens. I think the Ravens were interested, seriously interested.
I think maybe Seattle was too. There were a handful of teams that would have taken him, right?
Not that many, though, Nestor. Not that many.
I don't disagree with that.
I think what a lot of teams did, though, was they used all these other issues, and I put them in quotes, issues, as reasons not to sign him. And a core part of this, the book I write, and a core part of this whole era is fear and how teams – let fear overwhelm them, mainly fear of being boycotted by more right-wing fans. And that was never going to happen. How many times do we see people say, I'm never watching an NFL game again, and NFL ratings still remain?
Michael Vick came back and threw passes. You know, they let Greg Hardy play. They've let everybody play, you know, except Ray Rice. He didn't let him play.
Mike Vick was in Leavenworth. I mean, right. Mike Vick fought dogs. There's people who've done far worse things, and the NFL lets them back in. If they really wanted.
Nestor and I had this discussion a lot, Mike. You know, there's 25,000 empty seats, and you say, are they ever coming back? And then all of a sudden, number eight begins to be Superman, and it's filled up with number eight jerseys again.
Right. They always come back. The fear teams have is often just so massively unfounded. I've never understood it. People will always watch this sport in huge numbers. You can sign guys that you think are controversial. No one's going to really leave. That's just not going to happen. And I think that a lot of teams used that fear of boycott, of protest, the fear of Fox News, the fear of a Trump tweet as an excuse not to sign him while they sign other guys, not even just some of the things that guys do criminally, but like some of the quarterbacks that were signed ahead of Kaepernick were jokes. I mean, they were complete jokes, some of these dudes that were signing. So look, I understand that whole point, but you know, right now Colin could play. I mean, I've kept touch with him and people around him, and he trains all the time. He could probably walk on almost any team now and play.
I think JP Lossman was the word you were looking for, right? I mean, I think that was what Mike Freeman is here. The book is out. You know, Don, I know you got one more. I do want to get to Lamar and what's going on the field right now too.
I do just have one quick one, and Mike Nestor knows I have a fascination for how folks get to where they are. One of my questions, I'm going to jump back to your experiences in Irvington. When I was there, I was a lowly sports writer on the Quill. And then there were guys, you know, like Chris Scherf and Rafael Alvarez and yourself who went on to become real writers. You know, I went on to pretend to write from time to time. But you and the Chris Scherfs and the Ralph Alvarezes. So my question to you is, where did this interest – I mean, you're a noted author now, a noted columnist. Where did this interest in writing come from? And did you write for the Quill when you were at St. Joe?
I believe I did write for the Quill. The writing was just something that, like playing sports or, you know, I like flying planes. It's like just in my bones. It just was, and no one really in my family has done a lot of writing. So I'm not sure where it came from, but it's just something I always love doing, especially writing books. Books are just, they're incredibly hard, but they're really getting deep into a subject like this one. It's complicated, is really rewarding. And actually being at St. Joe really, there were a lot of people who loved to write there. And there were a lot of teachers who really helped me be a writer, who helped encourage it.
St. Joe Teacher Appreciation Month. Freeman's
I was going to say, Mike, Nestor's paying tribute to all of his past teachers.
I had my 10th grade English teacher on Miss Monday. I want to give a plug out to Miss Monday. I had my first grade teacher on. Don's connected to most of them, which is really strange. But my 10th grade English teacher came on, and we discussed, and I'll throw this at you. A year ago, like literally today, my wife and I were in Seattle for that Lamar Russell Wilson game out there last year.
Yeah.
And we were flying to Hawaii afterwards for the first time in our lives. We had a bye week. And it was a rainy Saturday afternoon in Seattle. I know you're familiar with this. And yes. We're staying at the courtyard or whatever. We're in the room. And I didn't want to watch college football. I just didn't. And To Kill a Mockingbird came on. And I know I told Moeller about this. And we sat there spellbound through Gregory Peck. And I got pissed off and I got angry. It's amazing the things you learn, right? That come back to you even 40 years later that affect your writing, affect your worldview. Education's everything, man, right? Yeah.
One of the greatest lines in any book or any movie ever, stand up, children. Your father's passing. I mean, To Kill a Mockingbird is relevant today as it was the day it was written, right?
Yeah, it always will be. And those teachers at St. Joe were tough too, man. Woo.
Who had a real impact on you down there? Is there one teacher that stands out and you said, man, help me be who I am?
There wasn't one teacher. It was sort of the entire St. Joe sort of experience because – I mean, this sounds corny and like a cliche, but they really did, excuse me, they really did just push you to be your best. They pushed you hard. And if you knew how to respond to that, then you were good. And also I had an incredible mom. My mom was just remarkable. My mom sent me to St. Joe because she thought I was too interested in girls. You gotta go to an all-boys school. You're going to an all-boys school. But fortunately, Archbishop Keogh was right down the street.
There you go.
I was good to go.
And my parents started talking to me about Curly, and I'm like, ain't the girls there, dog. Not for me. Not Catholic high. I'm going to Dundalk is where right. I'm going.
Mike, did they still have Jug when you were there? Or was that
Justice under God, yes.
Yes, indeedy. Nestor, yes. When you misbehaved at the Mount, you ended up in Jug, as Mike said. Justice under God. You paid the price, did you not,
see,
Mike?
Yes.
I can't tell Moeller anything about my high school experience because he was my high school guidance counselor. He doesn't have to think about what I was like in high school. He remembers the Ovaltine version of me. Mike, I got to talk current football and not about Eagles, Ravens. We got a bye next week. People might find this at any point. But I'll go back to the beginning of having sports taken away for 6 months. And I guess this is the hot topic for the week because of COVID and whatnot. And I'll let you talk about anything you want with Lamar or anything that's current because so much of this has been about the book, and I hope everybody buys it. But, I guess when we talk about the NBA, and I saw LeBron the other night win a championship, and it almost looked like it was relief, quite frankly, more than fun or joy or fans or fans. You know, it was in a TV studio for 2 months. Same thing with hockey. Baseball's going to do their thing next week in their bubble in Dallas. They're going to have a champion. Boy, the NFL better figure out how to put a cherry on top here because the pandemic's coming back. It never went away. We got elections. We got a president that's going to bring in the militia to get him out. I mean, we got all sorts of things that could sort of delay us all getting together on a bus and going to Tampa the first week of February, right?
It could. And the NFL has really got to make some really important decisions in the next couple of weeks, mainly with a bubble. I mean, you're seeing cases pop up all over the league, which is kind of what happens during a pandemic. I mean, viruses don't play, man. Viruses, they don't care about the NFL. They don't care about anything other than what they do for a billion years. This is what viruses have done. So the league's going to have to really take some huge steps here, I think. I from everything I hear, they are really seriously considering having like a playoff bubble type situation. we can debate should they've had it into coming into the season, and could they even do something like that? I think they could have.
I don't think guys can be without their families for 6 months. I think that's a little crazy.
I don't know. I mean, the NBA.
You're making $9 million a year. Maybe you do it, right?
Literally. Yeah. I mean, it would have been very difficult, but this is a dicey time. And things could teeter one way or the other. I think the league has tried to really do its best and has done mostly a pretty good job, but you can't, I mean, look at what's happening. And the other thing I would say, I can't tell you how impressed I am with the Ravens organization overall. I mean, just how they've handled Lamar in 1,000 different ways, and I'm preaching to the choir here, but for people who are listening who aren't as familiar with, I mean, that coach has handled him as well as you could handle him, protected him, and let him also be him. I know that people are going to hear this and like, why wouldn't he do that? Some people don't understand how coaches get with guys like Lamar because he's so talented and because he runs so well. Because
he'd be a hell of a wide receiver.
They will try to change his position. Or even if he at quarterback, they will tell him not to run. What Harbaugh has done is just fantastic. It's just say, go do you. And that's what you want to do with a guy like that who is so good. Just design an offense to let him use his abilities. I can't stress enough how many coaches would not do that.
No one drafted him, right? So if you weren't willing to draft him, then you weren't willing to make him your Tyrod Taylor. And yes. If you weren't willing to do that or make him your Taysom Hill or make him your Slash or your court, whatever you were going to do with him, no one felt the investment was, I'm not building my whole building around a kid who runs into linebackers.
He is also Harbaugh has also been really good with the players behind the scenes about all the things we've just talked about the issues with social justice. He's been really good with Lamar and
well, that comes from Steve, by the way. So you know, Steve, we know that from the inside out. Steve was the one that said, "I'm going to be the first one to make a video." Literally,
they've been really good. I mean, in a million different ways recently, and I just wanted to point that out. They've been fantastic.
Mike, what's the as we move to wrapping up this interview here shortly, what's the takeaway? I mean, the book just sounds fantastic, and actually, I can't wait. I'm going to go out today and buy it for my grandsons because they love football. They're very much involved in this whole issue. They actually live in the real world versus the press. They actually live in the suburbs. And believe it or not, President Trump, they actually have black and brown friends. The president would find that shocking. And they go to birthday parties with black and brown friends. And they have sleepovers with black and brown friends. So yeah. Despite the fact that the president thinking that black and brown people coming to the suburbs is going to scare people, I think people in the suburbs looking around going, I'm not sure what suburbs he's talking about. Right. So hopefully that doesn't play. But what's your elevator speech about what you learned as you wrote this book?
I think the big thing is perseverance and how believing in what you really find to be true. Meaning there have been 1,000 different things said about Colin Kaepernick and about these guys, but for down to the player, and I interviewed and speak to a lot of the guys that were part of this movement, they sincerely believed in what they were doing. Their message was clean, it was sincere, it was heartfelt, and they wanted to make change. And I think the overall message is you can make change. Along the way, it was rough for these guys, but now look at what the NFL has done. Look at the attitudes that have changed in the league, how the league office has operated, how the Ravens.
It felt very disingenuous to me, Mike. I just want to interrupt you on that because, like I went away from the league, right? Like, there's COVID, there's, you know, gloves on, there's no sports. I'm building a new thing. I almost ran for mayor of Baltimore. I was doing a lot of things back in the spring, and I did the draft, and I went away, and I never thought they were going to play. And the first time I put it on, literally, was that Thursday night, and it was like, who are these people? I don't recognize this. This is the same league that was banning people and doing SOBs and having Jarrett do a fake knee. Like, I'm like, who are these people? So I'm still a little, and I've had every Anquan Boldin on the show and talking about what the, you know, who was doing what, who was pushing for what inside the league, but it really feels forced to me because I've met some of these cats, you know what I mean? The people that really run the league.
I'm with you. I'm talking more about the players. And also, like, there's still organizations like the Ravens who are sincere. There's a handful of teams that are sincere. I'm not sure about Goodell. No, I'm not sure about that. I'm not sure about a lot of the ownership. No. But I do think what's happened is the players have sort of decided, I don't give a bleep. I'm going to do what I do. And they are not getting as much headwind, not nearly as much as they used to. They're getting none, in fact. They're allowed to really sort of be themselves, say what they want for the first time in decades. So that part is good. And overall, too, talk about what the message from the book is also make change. Act on what you believe in, and you can change things. And I think we're going to see massive change. You see a lot of really pissed off people. Lines, which shouldn't be lines because you shouldn't have voter suppression to cause these lines, but you see lines around these voting places. The early voting is at an all-time high. You see all these different things.
I got mine right here. I just want to give everybody, if you're out there, vote. Please vote.
Vote. Mail. Don't drop it off in one of those fake drop boxes like in California. Don't do that. Do the real.
Amazing.
Or one of the ones that's been locked, right?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, we have one drop box in the county. It's locked. Yeah, absolutely.
One drop box in a county, Harris County in Texas, that's bigger than Rhode Island.
I know.
We don't have any voter suppression in the United States. None at all.
Doesn't happen.
Well, Mike, good luck with that. And listen, come back on. We'll talk some football. We'll talk some social change and all that stuff. And, you know, I guess for all of us who do sports for a living, we are happy they're back on the field, right?
Yeah, very happy. I really appreciate you having me on. I always loved coming on. You're a really terrific guy. And everyone that comes on your show loves doing it. So thank you. And thank you. And go Gales.
That's very kind of you. I appreciate that. That's very, very kind of you. Mike Freeman, NFL, the way to find him on Twitter, football's fearless activist. The book is out, and you can follow him from Sunday to Sunday and Monday to Monday. Hell, they played Tuesday night football last week. Be playing seven nights a week if they could. Don Moeller and I have merged the streams from WNST.net to Baltimore Positive. The hat out front should tell you so. Maybe I'll get that on the leg lamp in the back where my Dundalk High. I mean, you guys get me singing the alma maters. We're gonna have a sing off here before it's all over. Wearing pink for the crucial catch and for everybody out there and breast cancer and the ladies, giving a shout out because we're not all getting together and tailgating with the Royal Farms chicken the way we should be before the game. I'll be in Philly this week. Luke will be at the home games. I'll be on the road games. And I got a special mystery guest for Don Moeller next week. WNST.net, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore. We never stop talking. Baltimore Positive.